Hello, and welcome back once again to Surgery 101, the podcast series, app, and website brought to you with the help of the Department of Surgery at the University of Alberta. The last few weeks has been very interesting here at Surgery 101, working on the Surgery 101 survey, our new website at surgery101.org, and featuring our first student videos. This week, we're returning to our main sequence of episodes and starting a series that's going to run between now and Christmas on inflammatory bowel disease. This is the first of three episodes from Dr. Lana Bistritz, who's a new Surgery 101 expert and colleague of mine. She's a gastroenterologist at the Royal Alexandra Hospital. And over these first three episodes of the series, she'll be looking at the medical management of inflammatory bowel disease. And then in episode four, I'll be taking over and talking a bit about the surgical management of inflammatory bowel disease. So in this week's episode, which is episode one, she'll be talking about the epidemiology and pathogenesis of IBD. She'll be talking about risk factors and common symptoms in patients who have inflammatory bowel disease. She'll be looking at common investigations that are used to make the diagnosis. And she'll be looking at cardinal features and some of the complications and differences between Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. So, let's get ready to start our series on IBD here on Surgery 101.
Hi, everybody. It's Lana Bistritz. I'm a gastroenterologist at the Royal Alexandra Hospital in Edmonton. Thanks for tuning in today. Today, we're going to talk about the basics of inflammatory bowel disease. During today's session, we're going to talk a little bit about the pathophysiology and the presenting symptoms of inflammatory bowel disease, what sort of investigations you should be doing in a patient in whom you suspect IBD, and a little bit of the features to distinguish Crohn's versus ulcerative colitis. So in general, Crohn's and ulcerative colitis both comprise inflammatory bowel disease. These are chronic inflammatory diseases that involve the GI tract. They're very common, especially in the northern hemisphere, and the average family doctor will see both Crohn's and ulcerative colitis in their practice. It's important for a family physician to recognize these diseases early in their presentation before complications like malnutrition, fistula, and stricture have a chance to develop. As far as which patients you should suspect inflammatory bowel disease, there is a bimodal age peak that we see for these disorders. So the first peak would be in the age 20 to 30 range, and the second peak around age 70. So for a lot of these patients, they're young people, they're working, they're having families. So inflammatory bowel disease has a huge impact on patients' quality of life, as well as a cost burden. Previously, we had thought that there was a Caucasian predominance for inflammatory bowel disease, but more frequently now, we are seeing presentations of IBD in Asians and African Americans as well. As far as the cause or the pathogenesis for inflammatory bowel disease, it is multifactorial. There's certainly a genetic predisposition, and we do see increased rates in identical twins versus fraternal twins, and the rates are increased in people who have a relative with Crohn's or colitis, but it's not a one gene type of disorder, and multiple susceptibility genes have been identified. So although people have a genetic predisposition, just because you have a family member with Crohn's or colitis does not mean you'll develop it. As the other component to the pathogenesis of inflammatory bowel disease are environmental triggers. We do see it more often in northern climates, and it's seen almost solely in developed countries. In developing nations, it's very rare. So the thought is that there is some sort of a triggering factor, whether it's a dietary component or more likely a microbe, that penetrates the usual gut mucosal barrier. And this trigger would then lead to dysregulation of the immune response in a susceptible patient, and ultimately chronic inflammation involving the bowel. As far as the other modifying factors, breastfeeding does appear to be protective. Again, this may help to enhance the gut barrier and reduce antigen penetration across this barrier. So we do advocate breastfeeding for Crohn's and colitis patients. Also, smoking certainly increases Crohn's and portends a worse prognosis. However, it does seem to be somewhat protective for ulcerative colitis, and patients with UC can actually flare when they quit smoking. Nonetheless, obviously, we don't advocate smoking to control the disease in patients with UC. As far as symptoms, symptoms for inflammatory bowel disease really depend on the degree of inflammation and the anatomic location of the disease. So if the patient has involvement of their small intestine and colon, chronic diarrhea would be the most common symptom. And especially if the distal colon and rectum are involved, rectal bleeding is a common symptom. If the rectum is severely involved, the patient may also have urgency, tenesmus, and sometimes may paradoxically even have some constipation-type symptoms. Chronic abdominal pain would be another common presenting symptom, and that can be in a variety of locations depending on which area of the intestine is involved. In patients who have Crohn's disease, who develop stricturing-type complications, they can have obstructive symptoms like nausea, vomiting, pain after eating. The other specific symptoms to Crohn's disease would be evidence of inflammation all the way from mouth to anus. So oral ulcers may be noticed by the family physician or by the primary care dentist. And some patients with Crohn's disease will also develop perianal fistulae or fistulae to the skin or to the vagina, which may be noted. In general, these are chronic inflammatory conditions, and so the high levels of inflammatory cytokines can cause general symptoms like fatigue and weight loss. And there are also extra-intestinal manifestations that you should watch out for, including arthritis, either of the peripheral joints or back pain, like a spondyloarthropathy. And patients can also have rashes, specifically pyoderma gangrenosum or erythema nodosum, and they may have red painful eyes from uveitis or iritis. On the physical examination, it's always important to get a body mass index and vital signs to determine if there's any evidence of systemic toxicity. Abdominal tenderness should be assessed for, and in a patient who has peritoneal signs on examination, you would want to exclude complications such as perforation, toxic megacolon, or intra-abdominal abscess. Some patients, especially with ileal involvement, may have a right lower quadrant mask due to an inflammatory phlegmon, and that can sometimes be seen on their physical examination. And it's always important to do a rectal examination, so looking at the perianal region for any evidence of skin tags or fistula opening, assessing for abscess in that area, and you may see blood on the examining finger. So some of the features, including chronic abdominal pain, diarrhea, are very common in patients who don't have inflammatory bowel disease. And in fact, especially in a young patient, this could be easily confused for irritable bowel syndrome. So distinguishing those two clinically is very important. We try to keep an eye out for what we would term alarm features, which would be nocturnal bowel motions, blood in the stool, weight loss, evidence of anemia, elevated inflammatory markers in the blood, and your pretest probability for IBD should be increased if there's a family history of Crohn's or colitis. So those are people who you would want to make sure that there isn't something more serious going on before labeling them as having irritable bowel syndrome. In addition to irritable bowel syndrome, some of the other things to consider in your differential diagnosis would be infection. An infectious cause of colitis would be unlikely to cause chronic symptoms. However, both C. difficile and CMV can cause flares in the patient with IBD, and they should be screened for at any time that the patient's symptoms become worse. In addition to irritable bowel syndrome, lactose intolerance or celiac disease could also cause chronic diarrhea and weight loss. And a drug-induced colitis, most often from NSAID drugs, could also cause a similar symptom. In patients who are older, especially middle-aged women, microscopic colitis could cause chronic diarrhea and occasionally weight loss, and these could be differentiated based on endoscopy and biopsy of the colon. The other conditions to consider in an older person would be colorectal cancer causing rectal bleeding, anemia, change in bowel habit. And less commonly, endocrine causes like hyperthyroidism, diabetic diarrhea, and a neuroendocrine tumor could also cause chronic diarrhea. And in a patient who has a history of chronic alcohol use or pancreatic disorder, a pancreatic insufficiency could also cause chronic diarrhea and weight loss. As far as investigations, for the family physician, some basic blood work, including a CBC and iron indices, as well as B12 and folate levels, would be important. Anemia in these patients can be due to micronutrient deficiency, or it can be due to an anemia of chronic disease. Blood work can also be done to look at levels of serum inflammatory markers, such as an elevated C-reactive protein, elevated ESR, and elevated platelet count, which all would show evidence of increased inflammation. As I said before, it's very important to rule out infections, so stool cultures should be done, including a sample for C. diff toxin. If there's any concern about perforation or toxic megacolon, plain films would be useful. However, the diagnosis truly is endoscopic and a tissue diagnosis is ideal. If the patient has very distal proctitis type symptoms, a sigmoidoscopy may be adequate, but especially if they have non-bloody diarrhea or right lower quadrant pain, a full colonoscopy and ileoscopy is often necessary. In a patient with Crohn's disease, we usually would see a range from focal aphthous ulcers ranging to deep serpiginous ulcers with a cobblestone pattern of mucosa. Versus in ulcerative colitis, the ulceration is more shallow, and they may initially just have loss of the usual mucosal vascular pattern, progressing to a granular appearance to the mucosa and ultimately friability with contact bleeding and adherent mucopus. Some patients with Crohn's disease may have isolated mid-small bowel disease out of reach of the endoscope. And for these patients, some of the newer endoscopic and radiologic investigations have become very helpful in our management of Crohn's patients. These would include either CT or MR enterography, which can identify inflammatory areas or strictures within the small bowel, and video capsule endoscopy or double balloon endoscopy to endoscopically assess ulceration and inflammation in the mid-small bowel. Barium studies these days have a very limited role, and the barium enema in particular is not useful in somebody who has symptoms of an acute colitis and in fact is contraindicated. The other indication for radiologic studies would be to rule out complications of IBD, and in that situation, a CT or an MRI can be useful to identify fistula and the fistula tracts, abscesses, and stricture. I had said already that the diagnosis is ideally based on tissue biopsy. And the expected findings on pathology for a patient with inflammatory bowel disease is basically evidence of chronic inflammation of the GI mucosa with alterations in the colonic or small bowel architecture that show that the process has been going on for some time. So usually that includes a lymphoplasmacytic infiltrate, distortion of the crypts and crypt abscesses. You really can't distinguish ulcerative colitis versus Crohn's by biopsy alone in most situations. So the pathologist needs to collaborate with the gastroenterologist to come up with the diagnosis based on the endoscopic distribution and appearance. The only exception would be if granulomas are identified on the biopsies. These are pathognomonic for Crohn's, but they're seen in only 30% of biopsies. So you can't hang your hat on the granulomas. The next thing to emphasize is the difference between Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. And this is mostly something that we can interpret based on the endoscopic distribution. So Crohn's can involve anywhere in your GI tract from the mouth to the anus, although 2/3 of patients will have the ileum involved, either the ileum alone or the ileum in addition to the colon. Also, Crohn's is discontinuous with classic skip lesions, so almost universally the rectum is spared in Crohn's disease, and then there may be patchy involvement of the colon or small intestine. This is in contrast to patients with ulcerative colitis, where the inflammation is confined to the colon only, and the rectum is universally involved. And then any area of the colon upstream from the rectum is involved continuously. So you may have a patient with just rectal involvement, or it may be rectum up to the splenic flexure, or it may ultimately involve the whole colon. The depth of inflammation also distinguishes Crohn's from ulcerative colitis. So in patients with Crohn's, the inflammation is transmural, and this explains why patients with Crohn's are prone to complications like fibrosis and stricture, because they have deeper levels of inflammation, and also fistula, either perianal fistula, enterocutaneous fistula, enteroenteral fistula, or enterovaginal fistula. And this is due to the transmural inflammation adjacent to another structure which eventually fistulizes through. This is in contrast to ulcerative colitis, where the inflammation is limited to the mucosa and submucosa, so you really don't see those fistulizing or stricture complications. The other major difference to remember between these two is that because ulcerative colitis is confined to the colon, it is potentially surgically curable with colectomy, whereas Crohn's tends to recur in most patients at the site of their resection. Complications are common in patients with Crohn's and ulcerative colitis, and in Crohn's, as I mentioned before, these usually are due to transmural inflammation, and they include stricture, abscess, and fistula. And for ulcerative colitis, patients can present with distension of the colon and systemic toxicity, which is termed toxic megacolon. Patients with ulcerative colitis also can have fibrosis of the intrahepatic and extrahepatic bile ducts, an autoimmune process called primary sclerosing cholangitis. And the other complication to remember in either ulcerative colitis or Crohn's patients with Crohn's colitis is colon cancer once the patient has had disease for over 10 years, and these patients should all be in an intensive screening program. The other complications of inflammatory bowel disease in general are related to malabsorption and chronic inflammation. So these patients are at increased risk of venous thromboembolism, and especially during episodes of flare, they should all receive heparin prophylaxis. The patients with Crohn's disease especially are at risk of micronutrient deficiency due to malabsorption, poor intake, or surgical resection. And these patients are at increased risk of osteoporosis, partly from malabsorption or poor intake, but also from repeated courses of steroids and even just the chronic inflammatory milieu that is involved with inflammatory bowel disease. Especially in the young patient population, the other major complication is reduced fertility. In male fertility, this is mostly patients who are taking sulfasalazine, and this is reversible. However, in women, especially if they're post-op from proctocolectomy and pouch formation, or patients with Crohn's disease who've had a lot of pelvic inflammation, fertility rates are reduced compared to the average population. So the role for primary care in these patients is crucial for adequate patient-centered care. The family doctor needs to have a low threshold of suspicion in order to recognize these conditions early. And it's the family doctor whose role is to coordinate subspecialty referrals, including referral to a GI specialist for endoscopic diagnosis and initiation of treatment. But then the family doc has a huge role in ongoing health maintenance for these patients. So vaccinations are very important for these patients, maintenance of bone health and nutrition, as well as preconception planning for these young patients. A lot of inflammatory bowel disease patients are also interested in complementary therapy, and good family physician is crucial in helping to coordinate that with more standard traditional therapy. So in conclusion, inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's, and ulcerative colitis are the most common causes of chronic inflammatory diarrhea that will be seen in the outpatient practice by family doctors in developed nations. Early recognition is important to avoid the development of complications. And remember that Crohn's and ulcerative colitis can be distinguished on clinical grounds based on the distribution of inflammatory change.
That's it for episode 1 of our new series on inflammatory bowel disease. Next week, we'll be looking at basic medical management. As I always say at this point in the podcast, we're very happy to hear from our listeners, so please email us at surgerypodcast@gmail.com. Please try out our new website, surgery101.org. It's got a lot of new features, search and the tag cloud and videos, lots of different stuff. So if you go to surgery101.org, you'll find a lot of material there. Also, please find us on Facebook. You can like our Facebook page there, and you can send us a tweet to surgery_101. Please don't forget about the Surgery 101 app, which is only 99 cents. And don't forget about Surgery 101 Notes, which gives you access to notes and background for almost 100 episodes now. I was talking to a student recently about Surgery 101 Notes, and she said for $4.99, it's the cheapest textbook she's ever bought. And remember, all the proceeds from Surgery 101 app and Surgery 101 Notes go into the Tom Williams Chair for Surgical Education on a non-profit basis and help us to keep making more episodes of Surgery 101 just for you. So, that's it for this week. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to seeing you back here on Surgery 101.